This is The Guardian.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonising the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.
Beim Quiz Wer weiß denn sowas? Erwartet dich der Gipfel des unglaublichen Wissens. Kennst du die richtige Antwort? 2018 wurde ein Wilderer im US-Bundesstaat Missouri dazu verurteilt, während seiner einjährigen Gefängnisstrafe A. rein vegetarisch zu leben, B. einmal im Monat den Film Bambi anzusehen oder C. ein Kinderlexikon über Tiere auswendig zu lernen. Die richtige Antwort ist B. einmal im Monat den Film Bambi anzusehen. Wer weiß denn sowas? Immer montags bis freitags um 18 Uhr im Ersten.
He's not in office yet, but already the world is trying to prepare for the second Donald Trump presidency.
He's been elected by the US people, but we will work with him and seek that common ground.
Sometimes what frontline politicians say can sound absurdly optimistic. That's the Climate Secretary Ed Miliband at this year's COP29 summit in Azerbaijan. And when it comes to the war in Ukraine, remember this promise?
Before I even arrive at the Oval Office, I will have the disastrous war between Russia and Ukraine settled. It will be settled quickly.
Where can Britain position itself as the war reaches another decisive moment? Is it Donald Trump's world again, and we're just living in it? Probably yes. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week, the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today is the former Green Party MP and former party leader, Caroline Lucas. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm more interested in how you're doing. We'll talk about COP and the shadow of Donald Trump in a minute, but I wanted to first of all ask how life has been for you since you left Westminster. The last time I spoke to you, you were still an MP. You were counting down the days until the end. How does it feel now watching politics from the outside, if that's what you're doing?
I am doing that, and still doing some writing and campaigning as well. So I haven't walked away from politics. But I must say the transition to becoming an ex-MP is more complicated than I thought it might be. I feel slightly more discombobulated than I was expecting. And I guess it is just because it's been such a big part of my life for so long. You know, I had 10 years in the European Parliament and then straight from there, 14 years in the at Westminster. And so after nearly a quarter of a century of sort of knowing what you're going to be doing every day, because it's kind of dictated by the agenda set by the government or the commission or whatever, it is taking me slightly longer just to kind of find my bearings, I think.
When you were in Parliament, it often struck me that your whole sort of reason for being there was to at least try to hold people to account. You know, the idea that you were somehow at close proximity to power and you could scrutinise it and ask it what on earth it was doing and so on. I wonder now, do you feel a little bit more like the rest of us outside here? That there's a feeling of sort of helplessness now. Do you feel that to any extent?
I mean, I certainly miss that bit of leverage that I had. I mean, I'm hugely grateful that I was replaced by a factor of four, if you like. So you've got four Green MPs there, you know, because it really did feel like I was on my own for a hell of a long time. Clive Lewis, the Labour MP, put it really well when he said, you know, you must feel like fellow Green MPs are like buses. You know, you've been waiting there for 14 years, nothing happens. And then just as you walk away, four turn up together, which is great, you know, that there are now four Green MPs and they're able to spread out themselves over far more issues than I was able to do. So
I know what I'm essentially asking you. And if you can answer this in a word or two, that would be great. Do you
miss it? Do I miss it? I knew that's what you're going to say. Do I miss it? Yeah, of course I bloody miss it. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good. I will take, of course I bloody miss it, as the definitive answer. Right, let's talk about COP, the Conference of the Parties, to give it its more formal title. I thought I might begin by quoting Greta Thunberg. She said recently, during rapidly escalating climate and humanitarian crises, another authoritarian petrostate with no respect for human rights, is hosting COP29. She's referring to the fact that this latest international climate summit, let's not forget, is happening in Azerbaijan. And the president of that country has told the summit that oil and gas are a gift from God. It is a little bit sort of grimly ridiculous, isn't it? The location of it.
It is. It is grimly ridiculous. And, you know, it's very easy to run through all of the reasons why, you know, there is so much obscenity in the way that it's being held. I mean, we had discussions yesterday, didn't we, about one of the Azerbaijani ministers has been doing oil and gas deals literally, you know, in the days running up to this summit. I heard stuff today suggesting that those oil and gas deals are being done literally, you know, within the parameters of the summit. So on the one hand, you can point to the fact that oil and gas deals are being done, that some of the key players haven't shown up at all. And of course, overall, the whole thing, there is the shadow of Trump.
Pause there, because that's, I want to talk about exactly those mm-hmm. things. The first one about not many people with any power anyway showing up. I could look back to past COPs, like the 2015 meeting in Paris. It was a very big occasion. Even the deeply disappointing Copenhagen summit in 2009, which I did some reporting on. And governments from around the world, senior figures, really did show up. I mean, leaving aside the huge question of what actually happened in the wake of those things, the people who were there reflected the urgency and seriousness of it all. And now there's this horrible tension. Here we are. It's said by a lot of credible people that the world is now going to breach the 1.5 degree cap on rising global temperatures that was the centre of what was agreed in Paris. We both know extreme weather events are ever increasing. Look at what's just happened in Spain. And then along comes this summit and it feels like a non-event because none of the right people from the world's various countries and their political systems have turned up.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are two ways of responding to that. I mean, clearly it is massively disappointing and it does sort of raise the question about what else are these people waiting for in terms of what the natural world is throwing at us in terms of the hurricanes and the monsoons and the floods and everything else, you know. So on the one level, you can say it is quite extraordinary that they're not there. And why is it that they're not feeling more public pressure in those countries that are democracies to actually make sure that they did show up? Another way of looking at it, to be kind of a little bit fairer, is just simply to say that there are some COPs that are bigger events than others. So, for example, right. The next one in Brazil is likely to be a bigger COP where they are going to be talking about the revised emission reduction targets. The summit that we had in Paris, of course, was another big one. And so I think if we saw the same level of no-shows next year, that would be a lot more serious than it is this year. This year, however, is important when it comes to finance. And I'm quite sure that those countries, the countries in the global south, the most vulnerable countries to the climate crisis, will be deeply disappointed that A, more leaders from the global north are not there, and B, not more money appears to be on the table yet. And even Keir Starmer yesterday sadly didn't up the amount that the UK was putting on the table. So we absolutely know that unless there is global finance, whether that's coming from individual governments or from the so-called innovative forms of finance by which people are talking about things like taxes on super yachts or taxes on flying or taxes on the fossil fuel companies, unless we actually have serious amounts of money on the table, those developing countries are not going to be able to make the adjustments that they need to be able to make, and that the deal that is at the heart of the whole COP process will fall apart.
Do you have any sense of, notwithstanding all the various sort of failings and the deeply anticlimactic sense surrounding the whole thing, of some kind of best realistic outcome here, something that might happen that would at least be a modest step or steps in the right direction?
I mean, there are some modest steps that I think could happen. So, for example, at the last COP, this new fund called the Loss and Damage Fund was set up, which was in recognition of the fact that there are developing countries who are unable to fund the level of climate damage that they are already experiencing. And this Loss and Damage Fund, in a sense, was supposed to be a recognition of the fact that climate change is already happening and the costs are enormous. I think we could start to begin to see some money now flowing into that fund. For years and years, the richer countries have promised the $100 billion a year, which has only been met once, I think, since the figure was set nearly 10 years ago. That figure needs to be revised upwards now for the next 5 or 10 years.
I just refresh our listeners' memory. That's money to pay for what?
It's money to basically enable those countries that are least responsible for the climate crisis to be able to, for example, right, invest in the green transition to get themselves off fossil fuels without having to go through that, you know, dirty industrial period, but to go straight to cleaner energy sources. It's for things like that.
Let's talk about the UK end of this, Keir Starmer and Ed Miliband specifically. It's worth hearing the optimistic version of what's been going on and the UK's role in it. This is Ed Miliband.
You know, it would be wrong to say that the US election is not discussed, but I think what's so striking about what's happening here is that whether you talk to business or whether you talk to other countries, people are getting on with this transition. You know, this is an unstoppable transition, and the reason is, and the reason I'm here, is this is in our national self-interest as a country.
Now, you and I both know there's not much else Ed Miliband can say. There's no point telling people that COP is a complete waste of time and Donald Trump's going to kill the planet. Nonetheless, when you hear those sort of sentiments, what do you think? It's a very delicate balance, isn't it, between realpolitik and having to make these proceedings still sound worthwhile?
It is, but I think Ed is right when he's saying that there is still all to play for, in a sense. Of course, it's just been made 100 times harder by the fact that the US looks likely to walk away from the Paris Agreement yet again, as they did in 2016. But it is also true to say two things. One, that the economic logic behind the shift to a greener economy is, you know, incontrovertible. I mean, even a state like Texas is now producing more wind and solar than, for example, a state like California. So there is an economic logic to making this shift. And secondly, of course, a lot of these decisions are made at individual state level. Right. And those decisions will still go ahead in a positive direction. So the most important thing really is the signal that Trump's language around hoaxes and scams and so forth. I think it's the signal that gives out that is the more dangerous thing, rather than actually whether or not it will put the brakes on climate action.
Now, as regards the UK's current position on climate action, The Guardian's Fiona Harvey got the scoop on Tuesday. She announced that Keir Starmer had a new ambitious climate goal to cut carbon emissions by 81% compared to 1990 levels by 2035. That's an upgrade from the 78% target outlined by Boris Johnson's government in 2021. Starmer received something of a round of applause at Tuesday's COP for that announcement. Do you think he deserved it?
Well, it depends.
Good laugh.
It depends. Well, it's like all of these questions, you know, compared to what the others are doing, yes, he did. Compared to what needs to be done, no, he didn't. And that's always the case, you know. I mean, it is without doubt the case that this government is one hell of a lot better than the last government in terms of climate and nature and in terms of just about everything else. But that is a stunningly low bar to clear. The fact that Keir Starmer has accepted the advice from the Climate Change Committee, the independent committee that advises government, is obviously a good thing. We could argue about whether or not the figure should be higher. And certainly if you were to take a step back and look at the overall architecture of climate action, then there's a very strong case to be made that countries like the UK, which are disproportionately responsible for the climate crisis, since we industrialized first and have been chucking CO2 into the atmosphere longer than most, we should be going much further and faster than net zero by 2050. Nonetheless, that is the target that exists. 81% reduction is certainly one of the most ambitious ones that are being announced. So to that extent, I'm happy to give some credit. I think where the question really will lie, though, is what's the delivery plan? You know, targets to some extent are cheap unless they're really backed up.
Right.
And what worries
right.
me about the government at the minute is that they're putting all of their eggs in the basket of decarbonizing the electricity supply, the power supply. And they are not looking at all at agriculture and food or transport. I mean, take transport, for example. Transport is the biggest emitting sector in the UK at around 34% of emissions come from transport. And yet in Rachel Reeves's budget, we saw yet again another fuel duty freeze. They gave the green light to expansion of aviation at Stansted. So there's a very mixed story here. And there's a real concern, I think, that outside of the power sector, we're simply not seeing the level of change that's needed. And then we had Keir Starmer, of course, kind of saying that he's not going to tell people how to live their lives.
I mean, it sounds like cakeism. It's like climate cakeism, isn't it? He wants to be seen as Mr. Climate Action, but he doesn't want that much
exactly.
to change.
Exactly, and that isn't going to work.
Yeah, of course. And although on paper he's got this huge Commons majority, as you and I both know, they got 33% of the vote, the Labour Party is always terrified, isn't it, of trying gently to remind the public that perhaps life is going to change, and therefore we worry. Having said that, there is a much bigger worry in the foreground now, and you've mentioned him a couple of times. What's your biggest fear about Donald Trump's election? You said that inevitably he sends out signals to other governments around the world, democratic and non-democratic, about the idea that this is all a load of got-up rubbish and they can just revert to where they were prior to a lot of noise being made about climate and all the terrible things that would cause. I mean, it's hard, isn't it, to sound anything other than pessimistic and resigned to things going backwards.
It is. I mean, I want to restate the point that I made about the economic logic here, because it is true that a shift is happening in any case, irrespective of what Donald Trump or anybody else says, because increasingly green energy is cheaper energy. And that is something to hold on to. But in the meantime, certainly there is a massive amount of damage that he can do, both in the States and in terms of the kind of cover that he gives, the support that he gives to populists right across the world, who are increasingly looking at climate as something that they want to weaponize. Putting money on the table for the transition is even more important. And that's where I really do have a gripe to make with the Labour government. And that is on their resiling from the famous $28 billion of green investment. Because if we are going to be asking people to make changes to their lives, as we've established that we will have to do, then we have to make sure that that transition is one that is properly paid for and that it does not happen off the backs of the poor. And we have to do that for two reasons. The moral reason, which is that the poorest people should not be paying a high price for the transition. But secondly, if we give any inch to the argument that climate policies cost the poorest people, then the people who will be rubbing their hands with glee about that will be the populists, and we will see an even greater weaponization of the climate issue. And it really worries me that if we don't have money on the table for the transition, then it will not be a just transition, in spite of all the rhetoric about that. And we will see, you know, massive resistance to climate action, and B, the even greater rise of populism. And I think that's a very, very big risk.
That idea on the right of politics that the climate transition will hit people in the pocket, as you've just said, you hear all the time. We heard it at PMQs on Wednesday when Kemi Badenoch berated Keir Starmer for making commitments at COP that she said would make life more expensive for everyone. So it's there, isn't it? This isn't some abstract thing. This is absolutely central to the sort of language of the political right. It does feel like climate crisis has become a culture war issue, doesn't it?
It's absolutely at the heart of the culture war issue. And one way that I think we could begin to address that, because I've been thinking about this a lot, is putting more focus on the issue of climate adaptation. So at the minute, you'll know, in climate debates, there's mitigation, which is basically about getting our emissions down, and adaptation, which is about recognizing the amount of climate damage that's already kind of stored up in the atmosphere and is coming our way, and therefore, how do we make ourselves more resilient to it? Climate adaptation, the funds for it and the policies around it, in this country, as across the world, is woeful. If we could start thinking about how we make communities more resilient to climate change, then I think there's a way of standing alongside people in a much more practical way. And that would actually mean something to people for whom at the minute a debate about parts per million or percentages of this, that or the other feel incredibly remote and just feel as if that doesn't have anything to do with their own lives.
Yeah, I can see that. Anyway, here's the last question. I think I always ask you this whenever I speak to you. I'm asking you for a bit of hope here. It does feel harder and harder to find any, but particularly for young people, what's the answer to the question of an optimistic, albeit realistic, view of all this that makes it worthwhile getting out of bed in the morning?
Well, this is the fight of our lives, but at its heart, it's about what kind of world do we want and what kind of relationships do we want with each other and our world. And I think there are huge numbers of people who recognize that we are currently living in a way that is out of kilter with the natural world, and it's not doing us any good in terms of our own mental health or physical health, as well as not doing the planet any good either. And I think the fact that there are so many win-wins out there in terms of finding a way of living that is going to be far better for our own well-being and our mental health, at the same time as being better for the environment and all of the other species that we are so blessed to share this planet with, I think that prize is such a big one. And there are so many good people doing so much to try to achieve that. Then I think there is room for the kind of hope that Rebecca Solnit talks of. Rebecca Solnit, a wonderful US author.
And Guardian columnist.
She talks about a distinction between hope and optimism. Optimism, she says, is kind of like sitting on your sofa clutching a lottery ticket, hoping or feeling optimistic that you might be successful. Hope, she says, is the kind of thing that breaks down doors with in an emergency. You know, it's that sense you've got to get off that sofa and you've got to be out there because it's the battle of your lives and because it's worth fighting. And I think that personally gives me hope, and I think it can give young people hope too.
Yeah. It always works, that question, and it worked again. Thank you for joining us, Caroline.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be joined by The Guardian's defence and security editor, Dan Saba, who's in Ukraine, on what the next 6 months could look like for that country.
Die KI-Teammitglieder von Asana verknüpfen ihre Ziele mit relevanten Projekten. So ist jedem Team seine Rolle im Gesamtbild klar. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I am now joined by The Guardian's defence editor, Dan Saba, who is in Ukraine. We're going to talk about some of the possible consequences of Donald Trump returning as US president and what feels like a hugely significant moment for Ukraine, Europe and the whole world. Dan, first of all, tell me where you are.
Oh, I'm in Slovyansk in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. I'm out here all week, spending some time with soldiers on the front line, actually trying to gauge some of the mood in response to some of these big political questions. And also just to find out how things are going. Truth is, the war's not going brilliantly for Ukraine at the moment. They're being pegged back on the front line.
Right. You mentioned the mood there. I mean, that's a fascinating question, I think, to ask, is how people actually either involved in the war as soldiers or Ukrainian people who are equally involved in the war in a slightly different way, how their mood possibly has changed or shifted because of the fact that Donald Trump is about to become the American president again.
I think one thing you always have to remember in these situations is, you know, politics makes its own noise over there. And when you're on the ground, whether in Kyiv talking to Ukrainians or out here in the East, it feels very different. The war is part of people's present day reality. If you're a soldier, you're fighting it on a daily or nightly basis. So you don't sit there and you might not even have time to think very much about Donald Trump. And the first reaction is often, well, look, our war's against Russia. We're fighting Russia. If we have to, we'll fight on and we'll fight on without the US. And a lot of soldiers will say, well, in most cases, we don't use very many US weapons. So will it make a lot of difference? Although one thing they all use is Elon Musk's Starlink for communications. Absolutely critical.
That's how we're having this conversation, just to be clear.
Yeah, and just losing that alone actually would be really damaging for the war effort. And in Kyiv, I've heard quite the full range of emotions from, I'm actually pleased that Trump's been elected because he might actually force everyone to talk, make peace. Too many good people are dying on the front line. There's an acknowledgement, I think most Ukrainians will say, look, we can't get these occupied territories back, however much we'd like to. But what they'll also say is, we need proper security guarantees, and that means something like NATO membership or something that looks like it. And it's not clear that's on the table from the US.
So it's interesting. Obviously, it's registered. Clearly, you're asking people about it. But there's another question. Let's leave Donald Trump momentarily aside, which is what your sense is of what both people fighting the war and people involved in it in different ways, what their sense is of where the war's going after all this time. And morale, I suppose, is what I'm asking you about.
Look, morale is becoming more problematic. When the war started, everyone was on adrenaline only and wanted to sort of fight this extraordinary and stunning Russian invasion. You know, that phase, the adrenaline only phase, has long since gone. There was a hope perhaps up until about a year ago, that Ukraine could force, you know, conduct a successful counteroffensive and kick Russia out of all the territory it occupied. That's clearly not the case, and there's a kind of realism about that. Ukrainians are tired, they're fatigued, but they also see an oppressive neighbor constantly trying to attack them and destroy their way of life. So they still want to fight on despite the fact the human cost is growing. And, you know, Ukraine is losing good people, and increasingly there are sort of growing signs of, this is around the edges, but growing signs of sort of soldiers going AWOL or deserting. Not good signs in the medium term. They're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. They're in a war that's gone on a long time. They're tired of it. They lost a lot of good people, but they don't really see a way out that's attractive either.
Do you have a sense of what the impact will be? I mean, the most likely impact of Trump returning to the White House. I mean, unfortunately, it's in the nature of Trumpist politics that the way that you read the runes means you have to deal with things that are absurd and awful, but important, it seems. So we both know probably that Trump's son, Don Jr., put up a social media post at the weekend. I mean, it seems obscene almost telling you this while you're sitting in a Donbass, but I will.
Yeah.
He suggested that Zelensky was about to lose his allowance, right, by which he means military aid. Do you think, I mean, it seems to me we probably are. We're faced with something as drastic as that, in all likelihood.
Possibly. I mean, it's such a puerile way of putting it, isn't it, John?
Yeah, to say the least, yeah.
The first thing everyone says about Donald Trump is he's unpredictable. Well, fine, that's true, it doesn't take you very far. In fact, if anything, it leaves you a bit more confused. The balance of probability is that Trump is going to cut or curtail or threaten to cut or curtail military aid to Zelensky, perhaps as part of an effort to force Ukraine into negotiation with Russia. But there's another part of that, which is what Trump's also going to try and do, it looks like, is to see if he can do some kind of deal with Putin or come up with some sort of proposal that would be acceptable to Putin. And I think the problem is there are circles which so far cannot be squared because of Russia, the Kremlin's maximalist demands that Ukraine is a neutral state, is never a member of NATO. In fact, that Ukraine is demilitarized and, whatever this means, denazified. And so with those kind of maximalist demands, well, Ukraine's not going to agree to a lot of these, Ukraine itself, and will try and carry on without the US. So, you know, Trump may pride himself on being a deal maker, but there's so many contradictions to be reconciled, he may not find it possible to do so.
Joe Biden has got a couple of months left. There is a lot of noise around about the idea that, unbound, so to speak, he could make a material difference in his final phase in office. Keir Starmer will be in Rio next week for the G20 meeting, and it looks like he'll be pushing for the states to give a $20 billion loan to Ukraine before Trump arrives in office. And he's going to push to allow Kyiv to fire Storm Shadow missiles. Are you hearing anything about that?
Oh, I mean, no love for Joe Biden here in Kyiv, to be frank, amongst the, you know, Zelensky and his team. They're rather exhausted and worn out by Biden's strategy of incrementalism, providing just enough help to keep Ukraine in the game, but not quite enough to really inflict a decisive blow on Russia for fear of escalation, for fear of starting a wider conflict, which Russia has shown no appetite to do. And then, on top of that, not much love for Keir Starmer either.
Yeah, right. So pause there for a minute, seeing as you mentioned this. You broke a story on Saturday that the Ukrainian government thinks that Britain under Keir Starmer is dragging its feet and is much less supportive than Britain was when we had a Tory government. So a startling story. Ukraine, this is a quote from what you wrote. Ukraine is growing increasingly unhappy with London as Russian troops advance in the east of the country at their fastest rate since 2022. An unnamed official said, quote, Starmer isn't giving us long-range weapons. The situation is not the same as when Rishi Sunak was prime minister. The relationship has got worse, unquote. That's obviously significant. Do you think it was a provocation, really?
Yes.
Designed at bringing Starmer up short so that he does what he says?
So that was a story written by myself and my colleague, Luke Harding. And yes, it quotes an unnamed official, but this is someone who is well-placed, so close to the government, shall we say. And you can be sure they were very eager for us to write this. And sometimes when you write these stories, you check back and you check back again and say, you want us to say this. And the Ukrainians wanted to send a message to the Labour government. We're frustrated with you. We're fed up. You don't seem to have any of the enthusiasm of Boris Johnson, and you don't seem to be providing us weapons. And although very fixated on a single weapon, this Storm Shadow long-range missile, what Ukraine still thinks in this 2-month window, and I think this is very optimistic, but nevertheless, what Ukraine still thinks is that if they were allowed to use Storm Shadow for long-range strikes inside Russian territory on military targets, air bases, and logistics sites, that would be a wake-up call to Moscow and might force them into considering negotiations. I'm not sure it's right, but Ukraine wants to try that.
Right.
And maybe there's one last chance for Starmer to persuade Biden, because for various reasons, US support is crucial to allow this to happen. I have to say, I'm not very optimistic on either count, and I'm not optimistic it'll make a lot of difference. But nevertheless, you know, Ukraine is hoping against hope that there's one last card it can play before Trump's inauguration.
Presumably, you think there is truth to the idea that there is a gap between what Starmer says outwardly. I mean, as we both know, he was in Paris earlier this week in the company of Emmanuel Macron when they issued a joint communique saying they would support Ukraine unwaveringly and for as long as necessary to thwart Russia's war of aggression. You yourself would say that his actions actually fall short of that kind of talk.
There's a real rhetoric to reality gap at the moment.
Right.
Of course, in politics, you make high-level statements, but then you say, look, the proof of the pudding, the backup will come in time. You can kind of say that off the record, or you can start warming people up and sort of start saying, look, bear with us. We haven't got anything to announce just yet, but we're working on something and so on. But I have to say, at the moment, on this topic, number 10, Starmer, you know, and MOD are very, very quiet and offering no support on background. They sort of say, make these high-level statements and then provide no other backup. We won't tell you anything about Storm Shadow. We won't tell you what the direction of travel is. We won't tell you which way the wind is blowing. And that doesn't give you confidence. That doesn't give you confidence. And you sit there and you go, well, it's all very well saying that Britain and France stays with Ukraine as long as it takes. Because if the US doesn't, Ukraine's in trouble.
We've just mentioned what you wrote and the Ukrainian suggestion that Britain supported Ukraine in a much more meaningful way when the Tories were in office. Just harking back to that period, I wonder whether you think that the West gave Ukraine false hope. At that point, there was an idea of staunch, absolute support for Ukraine. Boris Johnson was brimming with this stuff. It became almost politically incorrect to question the idea of complete Ukrainian victory. And if anyone mentioned negotiations at that time, that was held to be tantamount to encouraging some sort of sellout and giving Putin what he wanted. Do you think, looking back, that perhaps created a huge expectations problem as far as Ukraine's concerned?
I think looking back, it's very clear now that there was over-optimism both on the part of Ukraine and on the part of the West. And those things reinforced each other. So I think the West thought that sanctions on Russia would be more effective than they were. They haven't been that effective. That certain weapons, I think the West thought, for example, give Ukraine a few tanks, a few dozen tanks, and they could achieve a breakthrough on the front line. That didn't happen. The Russians were a bit smarter and clever about reinforcing than we thought. And I think consistently Russia and the Kremlin have been underestimated in their determination or their malevolence, however you want to characterize it. And yes, so that has been a problem. And I think what Ukraine needed and still needs is a decisive step change in support to really put the Russians under pressure. And that would be something like, and these things aren't really on the table even now, Western air power in support of Ukraine, or perhaps Western troops to garrison the West to allow Ukrainian forces to be pushed forward. And this is the fundamental problem. People want Ukraine to win, but they don't seem to be giving Ukraine the tools to win. And we don't seem to be having an honest discussion about the tools that Ukraine needs and whether that's a price worth paying.
Thank you for joining us, Dan. Stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll speak to you soon. And thank you out there for listening. As you've just heard, our defence editor Dan Sabbat is in Ukraine reporting on the ground. It's going to be a huge year for Ukraine and the impact of Donald Trump's presidency on us and geopolitics as a whole. And in order for us to bring you reliable, brilliant reporting, we need your support. I know not everyone can afford to pay for news right now, but if you can, please choose to support The Guardian and our journalism. You can click on the link in the episode description. You might also be interested in a Guardian Live event taking place on Tuesday the 3rd of December, live at the Barbican in London. Marina Hyde, John Crace and this podcast's Pippa Creera will be discussing the year in politics. This will be a unique opportunity to see three of our most popular journalists in one place and hear what they say. Audiences will get their opportunity to ask their own questions to our speakers The event is held at the Barbican, but anyone can join virtually wherever they are in the world. Book your tickets on theguardian.com/live/year-in-Westminster or search Guardian Live Events. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj, who is about to have some time off for maternity leave. She will be missed, and I will have no one to argue with. The other person I have to mention, as always, is Nicole Chat.
This is The Guardian.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonising the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.